This is Martha Farah, and I am interviewing Steve Hyman, the president of the Neuroethics Society, here at Society's first annual meeting. Steve Hyman is a psychiatrist and molecular neurobiologist who, from 1996 to 2001, was the director of the National Institute of Mental Health. And since then, he's been the provost of Harvard University. So, Steve, let me ask you, first of all, why neuroethics?
This is a question that we asked ourselves on forming this society, which is to say there's a thriving field of bioethics, which is largely focused on the application of ethics to problems in clinical medicine. Why should we have a separate field and call it something like neuroethics? And I think the answer is that neuroethics goes far beyond the term ethics, although we're very happy with this rather catchy moniker that we have, calling ourselves the Neuroethics Society. Bioethics has dealt very well with such important problems as end-of-life issues, decisions on whether or not to keep treating, has dealt with ethical issues surrounding treatment access, has dealt with issues such as informed consent in research, and many other very critical issues. But the progress that we've seen in neuroscience raises a whole host of issues that really extend beyond the typical purview of bioethics. The brain, after all, is the seat of all of our thought, our emotion, our moods, and the control of our behavior. And as such, progress in brain research, on the one hand, creates enormous challenges for human self-understanding, and at the same time opens up a frontier of interventions for both people with symptoms of illness, but also people who are well, that raises very important questions both for ethics, but also for human self-understanding and for policy.
Speaking of policy, you served for, five years in Washington at NIMH. How did your time there overseeing the National Institute of Mental Health shape your perception of neuroethical issues?
I came to recognize that the public understanding of science, and indeed even the understanding of science by policymakers, including the Congress and other people in the executive branch, was often highly problematic with respect to their willingness to support science or their interpretation of results. So I think we have a critical role within something like the Neuroethics Society, both of deepening our conversations about these issues around progress in neuroscience, but also in informing a broader lay public about these advances. And let me give you a few examples. So one issue that has, we think, finally come to resolution in federal law is whether people with mental illness deserved insurance coverage on a par with people who have general medical illnesses like diabetes or pneumonia. Oddly, the parity bill, as it was called, that would provide insurance parity for people with mental disorders was sitting in the Senate and was used as a vehicle on which to attach the $700 billion bailout bill. The Senate needed some sort of vehicle that was already moving through, and this was it. So as a side effect of passing the bailout, we now have insurance parity for mental disorders. But my goodness, it's 2008, and how is that possible? And it's very complicated. I mean, a certain amount of it is anything that wasn't covered as the age of managed care was a target for people paying insurance bills and for insurance companies in order to keep things cheaper. But in fact, of course, mental disorders were very much misunderstood to this day. Although mental disorders are very real in terms of distress and impairment and even mortality because of suicide, there are no objective medical tests. We can't hold up a brain scan and say, this is a case of schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. Of course, we have useful research using brain imaging technologies in the laboratory, but this doesn't yet extend to the world of diagnosis. And so there was this sense that mental disorders were somehow less real, less diagnosable, and it is taken literally until 2008, using all kinds of evidence, including the outsized impact that mental disorders have on disability in the United States and worldwide, to convince policymakers, employers, and insurance companies that it should be covered. But there are also many other issues that come up, including the use of powerful psychopharmacologic agents in children, such as stimulants and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which have become very controversial, and the world needs a sophisticated understanding of the appropriate role of psychopharmacology in treating developing brains. There are issues that arise because many psychotropic drugs work both in people who are ill, but also people who are less ill or not ill. And so there are issues around cognitive enhancement. All of these things warrant deep discussion.
So what are the concerns about pediatric psychopharmacology?
Many people in society at large see only the environmental causes, the environmental side of pediatric behavioral disorders, psychiatric disorders, and don't recognize that these children who have these disorders are also bringing something to the table with respect to genetic risk factors and neurodevelopmental factors. And the second step in this logic is if you think something is caused by parenting or schools, you also might think that only behavioral and psychological interventions make any sense. In fact, I think we need to explain and discuss with, again, policymakers and society these issues. First of all, the brain is the great integrator. It integrates bottom-up forces from genes and the unfolding of the neurodevelopmental program with lived experience, environmental toxins, and these interact in an inextricable dance to produce our brains and therefore our thoughts, our emotions. And it might be that something has a 50% environmental contribution or even a larger one, but it might turn out that the best way to modify the nervous system for somebody to function well in society might still be pharmacological. And it might be that something is highly genetic. Think of the inborn error of metabolism, phenylketonuria, where if you have dietary phenylalanine, you develop toxic products in your brain and retardation, and the intervention is entirely behavioral, which is to remove phenylalanine from the diet. In short, it's very important for people to understand that we don't separate radically into Cartesian worlds of biology and soul stuff or even more tangible experience, but that both of these things come together in the brain. Now, the prejudice against any use of medication comes, again, partly from the belief that childhood apparent misbehavior must be environmental and therefore treated by environmental causes. I think it's really an empirical matter rather than anything else as to what will help a child function in society. And these empirical tests show that, for example, stimulants are safe and effective for treating ADHD. But then we come to this huge gray zone. That is, the boundaries of ADHD are partly socially constructed. Now, I'm not saying ADHD isn't real, that there aren't kids in the left tail of the bell curve who aren't severely affected. I'm quite convinced that this is a real disorder, but I'm also convinced that this is the characteristics of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which are inattention, hyperactivity, and impulsiveness, are all continuous with normal behavior. And the precise place where we put a cutoff on where we might consider medical treatment is a matter for judgment. And again, this will require a thoughtful and deeply educated medical profession and public at large.
You're saying, I think, that we, as a public, as a society, we may fail to appreciate the role of biological interventions in helping kids with psychiatric disorders, including ADHD. But others have been critical of the use of medications and said that we're over-treating ADHD and other kinds of disorders. How do you reconcile these two points of view?
I think what is true is that the diagnosis is not a diagnosis with objective medical tests that gives you a simple bright line, but rather it is a diagnosis that shades off into being well with a very large gray zone. And clearly we don't want to expose kids who are less impaired to the risks of medication needlessly, which demands a judgment call. And I think if you look at the data in society, what you have is in some communities there are enormously high rates of prescription of stimulants, and in other communities probably much less than we think is the epidemiology of ADHD. So I think what we see certainly in the United States is both too much and too little with respect to treatment. But I think there's something else which we have to think about, which is if we recognize that experience is written into the brain, right, and you have to ask yourself, what are the risks of not treating? That is, if a kid is clearly in the impaired end of the bell curve and perhaps less in this gray zone and certainly not well, what are the implications of not learning in school for many years, of being called a bad kid all the time, of being extruded by pro-social peers and ending up sort of with the bad kids? I think these can be as problematic and indelible as any concerns we have about medication and what medication symbolizes to kids. So clearly we don't want to treat kids who don't need it, right, who could do well by other means. But we shouldn't be philosophically opposed to treatment and then leave kids who are troubled with no recourse and force them to underperform their gifts and essentially end up in the bad kid bin of life.
As the first president of the Neuroethics Society, what do you see as the accomplishments of the society so far in addressing these kinds of societal challenges and others? And let me also ask at the same time, what do you hope to accomplish in the next few years?
I think the society has already accomplished a great deal. Here we have our first annual meeting, and there's 180 attendees from many disciplines and many countries. And we've begun to have just the kinds of conversations about issues ranging from pediatric pharmacology to decision-making and free will to enhancement, and later tonight, the ethics of deep brain stimulation, a recently revitalized form of psychosurgery. So I think these are wonderful conversations. I think the important goal is to bring people of many different disciplines together to think through these very important issues. Obviously, neuroscientists, diverse clinicians, psychologists, although I hope that in the future there won't be any clear bright line between psychology and neuroscience, philosophers, lawyers, policymakers, and others, in order to think through the implications of brain research for such areas as personal responsibility or interventions in the brain to enhance functions and many of the other issues that we have been talking about.
That's fantastic. Well, Steve Hyman, thank you so much. And now we will let you go back down to the meeting where those very issues are being discussed.
Thank you very much.